Want flexibility? Take yoga. Want flexibility with your health insurance? Check out United Healthcare Insurance Plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly medical, dental, and vision coverage that may be right for you. More at uh1.com.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads, generally, for most people, are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Hey, before we get the show started, I wanted to let you know we are giving away a bunch of brand new Black Magic gear.
Yeah, cameras, switchers, DaVinci Resolve licenses, a bunch of awesome stuff. So stay tuned to learn how you can enter to win free gear from Black Magic, and we're going to tell you all about it later on in this episode. Now cue the music.
Hey, welcome to the 170th episode of Just Shoot It, a podcast about filmmaking, screenwriting, and directing.
This episode was brought to you by patron Alex Schwartz. I'm Oren Kaplan.
And I'm Matt Enloe. Today we've got Drea Clark on. She's a festival programmer, a producer, a podcaster, jack of all trades.
She even taught at USC Film School for a while.
Yeah, for like 13 years. So she is a wealth of knowledge. We could have talked to her for another 15 hours. But we dive in a ton on the insight that she has garnered from being in the festival game for so long and how she applies that to her producing career. How she picks projects, the ways in which she makes them stand out amongst the crowd, and how she applies her wealth of filmic knowledge to producing in general.
Yeah, and it's worth mentioning that she works at Sundance now and ran Slam Dance. So not the tiniest festivals you've never heard of.
Yeah, she's a wealth of knowledge and a real hoot. Also on the show, we're bringing back this segment, Call Sheet.
I wonder if like any of our listeners actually remember that we did this segment before.
I would say 10.
Yeah, 10 I think do. That's 10 is the episode that we last did it in.
It's been a while, but we're bringing it back. And I think that it's kind of retooled. Before, we were just trying to talk to as many different crew members as we could. And that's pretty overwhelming. And you end up wanting to talk to everybody for a super long amount of time. So we've retooled it. And we are looking at the hidden jobs of the filmmaking industry. People who you've heard of their job, but you don't really have a great understanding of what they do. So we're talking to my old friend, Elena White, who writes commercial treatments. So we'll talk about what she likes about treatments, what she doesn't, the things that she does to punch things up and make them even better to get huge directors even bigger and better jobs. But before we do that, we have one important pressing matter, and that is our Patreon page.
Yeah, we have a Patreon page, patreon.com/justshootitpod. It's a place for you to support the podcast. If you like what you're hearing, if you tune in every week and you feel like you get some value out of this, then check out our Patreon page and give us a buck a month.
Throw us a buck or two.
We appreciate it. And if you don't, we still appreciate you. Thanks for listening. But really, folks, if you don't give us money, then just tell other people about the podcast.
Yeah, that's almost as good. Maybe
that's the trade. Well, cool. Well, thanks for listening and on with the show.
Elena, welcome to the show.
Thank you.
Tell us what you do exactly.
I am a commercial treatment writer, which is a ghost writer for commercial directors, which basically means that I do technical and creative writing on behalf of the directors when they're bidding on commercial jobs, and that gets submitted to the ad agency along with a numerical bid that comes from the production company.
So we talk a lot about treatments on the show, and you were basically like the secret weapon of a director who's maybe too busy to really kind of dial in exactly what they want to say on a treatment, or maybe they're not like as strong a writer as you are. You're kind of, you know, you're lending your expertise on writing treatments to directors who want a little bit of extra help.
Yes.
How does a director find you? How do you get employed by these people?
So most of the companies that I work with are larger production companies, and they have anywhere from like 5 to 25 directors on their roster. So originally when I first started, I was working for a pretty big commercial production company, and I was a coordinator there, and my executive producer had quite a few directors on the roster who were French. English was not their first language, and although their speaking skills were great,
oh.
that's good.
Writing is difficult no matter what. So it's even more difficult when you're writing in a language that is not, you know, your first language. So I started rewriting treatments for some of the directors on our roster. And so that's how I got into it. And then from there, when I decided that I wanted to go freelance, there was executives and other coordinators at the company who were really helpful in getting my name out to other directors that they worked with, friends that they had at other production companies, the freelancers who come in and work on commercial jobs. You know, they might be there for a couple of weeks and then they are off to the next company, so they take your name out with them. Mm-hmm. So it was really more word of mouth and connection, which
just word gets out.
Yeah, that's how I did it. Now I do know other people who, you know, basically cold called production companies and emailed samples and, you know, made connections that way, but for me it was more word of mouth and people who, you know, having met all these people at the first production company that I worked at.
Now that you've kind of moved into doing this full-time professionally, it's not just people where English is a second language for them. It's kind of just anybody who needs help.
Yeah, exactly. And even before I left that production company, other directors who were under other EPs at the company had started using me. And it really just comes down to the deadlines are so quick. And you have your phone call with the agency, and then they're like, okay, you know, maybe can we get a treatment in like 2 or 3 days? And for instance, that director, if they're on another job, if they're, you know, in Budapest directing 3 days, you know, 3 day shoot, they're really not going to have time to sit down and write a treatment and make it sound good. So they hire someone like me who can help them out. Or, you know, again, if they're not the greatest writer in the world. And honestly, sometimes you just get directors who are a little burnt out because they've been directing commercials forever and they've written thousands of treatments and they just don't feel like they have a whole lot left to say in terms of writing treatments. So they'll hire someone like me for those reasons as well.
Do you have any moves you like to do? Or do you have any, like, what's your secret weapon? Well, what are you adding? What do you like to add the best, I guess, is what I'm saying.
I think the first thing is you always want to really make it feel as though the director wrote it themselves. You don't want to go so far afield into your own style that the agency reads it or the client, you know, at the end of the day reads mm-hmm. it and they know that there is no way the director wrote it. So for me, it's really paying attention to how the director speaks on the conference call, the kinds mm-hmm. of jokes that they make, you know, do they like to use, you know, multisyllabic words or do they really stick to short words and succinct sentences? You just want to make sure that that comes across in the treatment so that they feel like it's an extension of the person that they spoke to on the phone when they did their conference call.
Can I ask you a specific question about that?
Sure.
If they swear a lot on the call, do you try to put that into the treatment?
So, no, we usually don't put curse words into the treatment. I myself, as Matt can tell you, I have terrible potty mouth. So there will be times when I will try and work in a swear word or two into the treatment. This will be
fucking awesome.
Yeah, fucking awesome, I feel like, is the one. If you're doing like a beer commercial or like a sports spot, you could say fucking awesome. Tongue in cheek, right?
I've been trying to like pretend I'm young and I'll put like an AF. Like, oh, this will be cool AF. This will like make your socks.
Boy, Oren loves the fire emoji an awful lot in his treatments.
I think for me, where I tend to use it the most is actually when I'm writing out the story itself. So, for instance, if you have a character who you want to convey that they have a certain expression on their face, like a what the fuck expression, right? Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And I might write something in like italics that says, what the fuck just happened?
Right, right.
And sometimes I'll try and soften it by putting an asterisk in for the you. And it just depends on who the agency is and who the client is. Right. Sometimes I get away with it.
Butthole.
Yeah, sometimes they let it slide, but most of the time they're like, let's take out the cuss words.
And are you collaborating with a layout artist as well? Are they like helping with pulling? Because that's the other half of the treatment, right? Of course, it's like there's so many visual elements that are involved in that. How do you collaborate with those people?
So if I even know who the visuals person is on the job, my specific collaboration with them is more about, hey, when do you need to have the written words from me by in order to get your part of the job done in enough time?
Right.
And I tend to add a lot of my own ideas into the treatment. So these poor visuals people will get the treatment and they'll like read some weird stuff that I put in there. And then they're like, oh God, I got to like do a quick pull on these ideas that she added. So excuse my French, but it's like shit kind of rolls downhill.
Sure.
So I don't really interact with them too much beyond just coordinating deadlines.
Rolling your shit down the hill.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And I'm like, here's the treatment. Hope you like all the extra stuff I added.
Yeah. Well, but that's so interesting, though, because I think that's probably, you know, that's part of what they're paying you for, too. Do you know what I mean?
Like, yes.
It's not just articulate what the director said on the call in a more cogent way. It's like you still have to plus it, right?
100%. Yes, absolutely. You know, even when the director is on the call with the agency and maybe they're spitballing ideas back and forth and they'll throw out stuff that seems really great in the moment, but then when you're working on the treatment, it doesn't make sense in the story somehow. Mm-hmm. So part of the treatment writer's jobs, or at least I consider it treatment writer's job, you help make the story make sense. And there's some directors that I never speak to. I just listen to the call and I write the treatment off of that. There's others that I work with who I might, you know, talk to them for about an hour before I start writing, and just so that I can be a sounding board that he or she can bounce ideas off of. So for me, that's what makes the job interesting, is that, you know, you're not just some transcriptionist and you're not just, you know, putting sentences together. You're adding in, you know, you're plussing their creative vision with your own creative vision.
You're the secret weapon.
I try to be.
I really would love to know, like, kind of what the biggest mistakes you've seen in treatments, like what makes horrible treatments?
Let's see.
Well, she's never submitted one, so.
But I definitely have looked at a lot of...
I'm sure she's fixed many.
Yeah, that's true.
I have fixed treatments, and I always ask for samples when I'm working with someone new, just so I can see what their writing style is like. I think when you read treatments where they're trying too hard to be clever, I think where you read treatments that, you know, all of us... mistakes are going to get by, typos are going to get by. I'm terrible at spotting my own typos. Like at this point, I don't even typo check the first draft. I come back and check it later because I'm not going to see those typos. But I will see treatments that have been sent out that are just riddled with mistakes. And, you know.
Wow. Well, it sounds like that's something that's just like nice and straightforward, at least. Just, you know.
Yeah. Yeah. It's really just, it's that, just making sure your work is meticulous, and then also just not trying to be overly clever where it feels like you're being phony.
Right.
You know, just show genuine enthusiasm about the project. Don't be phony with it.
Yeah. Well, that's so wonderful. Like, what straightforward advice. Like, just kind of dot your I's and cross your T's and also be genuine. That's exactly what you want to hear. Do you know what I mean? Like, there's no booby trap to that. You know, it's
absolutely
just like, be a good student. Awesome. Well, thank you so much, Elena. This it's so great to get to have you on the show and to shed a little bit of light on this kind of secret sort of part of the industry. It's so interesting to me. We haven't done a call sheet in a long time, and it was because I was like, oh, this is the perfect thing. Like, everybody knows what a DP does. Who cares about that? Like, I want to talk to people where it's like, I am maybe a little foggy on what the job is. That's my favorite. So. Yes. Thank you so much for coming on.
Yeah, thanks, Elena.
Well, thank you for having me.
Hey, we're going to take a quick break because we have Seth Worley, one of the co-founders of Plot Devices, with us here in the studio. His company makes products that help filmmakers figure out their stories and storyboards and all sorts of cool things. Seth, can you tell us a little bit about your process of how you write a feature script and why the story clock is helpful for that?
Yeah, so I realized a while back that when I get a story idea, I don't just get one idea. I don't get a log line just broadcast to me. I get a big pile of ideas. Some of them are really well formed, like scenes, sequences, characters, themes. Some of them are weird, random, unformed ideas that need to be grown a little more. And because I have a loose sense of traditional Joseph Campbell story structure, I know where most of these ideas are probably going to fall in the story. So when I drop them in, inevitably there are big gaps that need to be filled to get me from point A to C. This is normally where I break down crying and give up and stop. Until I figured out this process, which made it a lot easier for me, by visualizing the story like a clock. If it's a 2-hour movie, the 30-minute point is at the 3 o'clock mark, the hour point is at the 6 o'clock mark, and so on. You'll find that, you know, your act breaks are normally right above 3 o'clock and right above 9 o'clock. And you take the ideas, your pile of ideas that you got, you drop them generally where they're probably going to fall in the story, and you pinpoint the gaps. And then by using symmetry, you can fill these gaps organically. Rather than injecting random weird ideas from the outside, you can extract ideas from what you already have. So if I see I have a gap at one point in the story, I can look at the opposite side of the clock to see where there are things that I could build on or pay off. It's a simple but effective way to be able to fill out the story and to get to an outline quicker and start writing. Whether you end up following that outline or not, it gives you at the very least peace of mind and confidence to keep going into the weeds.
Cool. Well, if you want to find out more about the Story Clock and the various products that Plot Devices makes to help you figure out your movie, check out plotdevices.co.
This week, this is the big one. We're giving away everything. That's right. We're talking storyboard notebook. We're talking Story Clock notebook. We're talking Story Clock workbook and your choice of a pin.
To win it all, go to Instagram or Twitter right now, tag at plotdevices.co, and let us know what movie or show had a plot twist that just blew your mind. And let's disqualify Sixth Sense from the get-go. For me, a movie with a twist that really inspired me was Memento. Totally changed what the entire movie was about. And then more recently, I really loved what happened at the end of the third episode of Russian Doll. Made that show so much more unique than I thought it was going to be. I really loved it. So let us know what movie or show had a plot twist that blew your mind, and you might just win it all. Hey, we are here with Drea. Thank you for coming.
Drea Clark, hello, welcome.
Hey guys, thanks for having me.
Your resume is super long and super complex. Right? You've got a lot of different stuff going on.
Drea, you're so old and unfocused. It's a delight to have you.
Well, I was aiming for a compliment. So
you're a master of all trades.
Yeah,
I'll take that.
Film critic, programmer, podcaster, producer.
Festival programmer. Yes,
festival programmer, pardon me. Yeah, yeah.
Oh,
and I want people giving me the computer.
JavaScript.
Exactly.
Sorry, Oren's disappointed, but I'm extra
excited.
Yeah,
that's why we're looking for engineer/filmmakers.
Ignore his LinkedIn request then.
Yes, my GitHub. Right, you know that website?
Oh, I'm so glad I don't. Yeah. No.
Drea, let's start with festival programming. What festivals do you program for currently, and which ones have you programmed for in the past?
I feel chronologically is the best way to explain my festivals because there's been overlap. I started in festivals when I moved out to LA many moons ago. I graduated from the University of Wisconsin.
Oh, cool.
Obviously, yes. Go Badgers. As you, I'm sure you know, like, obviously you think film schools.
Of course, of
and you
course.
Think Madison, Wisconsin.
I do want to say that it's great for listeners to hear because I think we get people writing in all the time that are like, should I go to film school or like,
oh, I have answers
I
for
went
that.
To a crappy film school and I feel bad about it. It's not a big deal.
No. I taught at USC School of Cinema for 13 years, and I don't think you should necessarily go to a film school.
Really?
I went to USC for it. Oh. Not 13, but
12 years.
Thank God. What did you teach?
I taught music video production.
Oh, dang. What?
That's the class?
I wanted to take that class so bad.
It was great.
That is a great class.
Yeah, it was great.
A lot of good videos come out of that class, too.
I thought so, and it was wonderful because I was able to bring in, this is going to be a very meandering thing because career, as you mentioned, has been very meandering.
I'm going to get you back onto film festivals.
No, it's okay because it does all tie in. I started in production working in music video. And so that was my background of learning the ropes, really. And it was great in terms of just hands-on experience because the turnover time is so quickly. Normally a TV show, if you're lucky enough to get crewed on that, you're locked in for a long time. Indie films, even a short one is still like 3 or 4 weeks. Whereas a music video, if you're on, you can kind of prove yourself as worthy and kind of make yourself. Cause you know, once people have a crew and a team, they like, those are the people you call first every time. So once you prove that you're not a dum-dum and relatively competent and easy to be around for very long shoot days,
sure.
then
you're good to go.
You're hopefully pretty good to go. So
if you can prove that without spending $45,000 a year.
Even better. But the festival thing, so I moved out here with no plan from Wisconsin. I just knew I was going to move to LA or New York, and I'm from the Midwest, so I was done with snow. It's like, sure. LA it is.
Yeah.
I didn't really have any contacts or a good solid plan, but you guys had a dream in my heart, and Midwestern work ethic. And
we all moved here, right? Yeah. I get you. Yeah.
I mean, well, step one is move here. Step right. two is figure out why you moved here.
Yeah, no, it's very real. I think the figuring out why is a huge part. And I studied communication arts, which was TV, film, and then English. And so we did more, there were some production classes, but it was more film theory and film mm-hmm. criticism mm-hmm. and developing an eye. And I think that's definitely helped my career as a programmer and looking at things historically, having context, like that helps when you're comparing films like against other films. But when I moved out here, I wasn't totally sure what I was going to do. I ended up making friends with some people who went to SC randomly. And one of them was interning. I didn't even know what interning was, by the way. Wisconsin was not like, make sure, go you're find like, an internship. Like I was
work for free?
Yeah, I was so walking blind. I can't even explain. And so she was like, oh yeah, I work at this film festival. I'm like, great, I'm bored. Do they want me? Mm-hmm. I'll do whatever. And then I stayed there for 19 years. So I started at Slam Dance as an intern. And then I moved into shorts programming mm-hmm. and really liked it and realized, oh, actually I was programming because in Wisconsin I ran the play circle, like our little art cinema in the mm-hmm. union. I'm like, oh, I called it picking films, uh-huh. but yes, programming. That's what I like. Okay, good. And then, so eventually I ran the Slam Dance narrative team for about 13 years and then was eventually the exec director of the festival for 2 or 3 years and produced the festival as well. And wow. actually Slam Dance, the other thing I fell in love with, Slam Dance has programmed, our team is entirely consists of other filmmakers, mostly mm-hmm. alumni filmmakers. So it's very different than other festivals and it's done in a really sort of diplomatic round table, mm-hmm. Diplomatic, democratic, one of those sure. sort of things. Yeah. I had to be diplomatic as the team leader. It's a democratic process. Right. But Slam Dance's whole focus is first-time directors. So all right. of our competition slate is. So yeah, Oren Peli, I programmed Lynn Shelton's first film.
Did you do Drake Doremus's?
Drake Doremus's first one, yep.
Well, your face is lighting up. Like, clearly you really loved those films.
Oh yeah.
Yeah.
The thing about being at a Discovery Festival, which is mm-hmm. primarily what I program, it's a whole trusting your gut thing. So it's twofold. One, you feel like you've been part of this film, even if you didn't help create it.
Sure.
When I mean, it
you
gets
are
there,
making careers, right?
Right, and you fought for it, and like, and then two, when they do succeed, you're sort of like, oh, I was a doula for their birth.
Sure, yeah.
How wonderful. But like Sean Baker, I programmed yeah. Sean's first film in 2006, and
yeah. Yeah.
And to have him, yeah, and to have him go on and make the incredible films he has. So the Russo brothers, Mark Forrester, like the amount of people who've come through.
What? You did his first movie?
Yeah. That was the Slam Dance of it. And then again, being in a festival meant that it was sort of seasonal. So I was still able to be in production. And that's when I was really working music video and festivals back and forth.
Wait, so are you still involved with Slam Dance now?
No, I've been at Sundance for the past couple of years. So I am now at Sundance.
I was going to say Liz Manischel. I can't
oh,
believe I didn't
Liz, yeah,
with Liz.
Of course.
Liz is a dear friend.
Oh, yeah. She's such a great human.
Yeah, yeah. She's the best.
Oh, good.
Yeah.
And Liz, I actually weirdly met through Film Independent. I've programmed the LA Film Festival for the last 10 years and was the senior programmer for the last 4 or something. And then I'm still at Film Independent as producer in residence. And then I've also, for the last 4 years, programmed Gina Davis's Bentonville Film Festival,
mm-hmm. yeah.
Which is a concentration on really looking for women and people of color and other underrepresented voices, both in front of and behind the camera.
Wait, what are you doing at Sundance? Programming also?
Yes, programming. I'm in the episode. We started an episodic right. section 3 years ago now.
And that's like TV?
It's TV.
Or web?
It's primarily TV. What are... Oh, I should... every year like blurs together so quickly.
The I think the early stuff was like,
but we showed Wild Wild Country was one of our premieres, which was this incredible documentary series.
And so do you show just the first couple episodes, or how does that work?
It's a split. So some of them, we have a...
You guys did OJ.
Oh, yeah. That was
the
this year.
The People Against...
And this year we did Finding Neverland as well.
Yeah.
The Michael Jackson.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. But like a marathon screening where you were just like, oh, we're going to watch all of this.
Oh, OJ. Finding Neverland, is it like a miniseries?
The Michael Jackson. Yeah. Well, it's it was like a 3 hours, 4 hours. The one that came out this year.
Right, right.
Yeah.
Oh, I thought it was like a 4 hour movie, but it's an episodic.
No. It was episodic.
But you showed it all at once.
Yeah.
Oh, wow.
And then these are all documentaries, but we showed a lot of scripted stuff too. But the Wu-Tang documentary, which ended up at Showtime, which I love. The episodics, there's something great about the structure of that. It's a different approach to how they're setting up the storytelling. Mm-hmm. And I like that it flexes different muscles for the artists. And so we show to us what represents the best of the best. So we'll have, we have independent pilots. One of the scripted pilots that we showed this year called Work in Progress just got picked up with Lily Wachowski as an EP it.
What's the lowest budget, least famous thing that you program? Like, do you, like...
At Sundance?
Yeah.
Well, you wouldn't have heard of it, but like, it's hard. It's a whole range. Like we also showed different lengths. We showed the entirety of State of the Union, which was starred Chris O'Dowd and... Gone Girl. Help me. Rosamund Pike.
She's like one of those, like a pretty blonde actress who I could not pick her out.
She's
of
great. She's so Hitchcockian.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah. And it's written by Nick Hornsby. Mm-hmm. It was directed by, well, you guys all have access to the internet.
But I mean, can somebody, like if Matt and I made a show, is there a way that could get into Sundance, or do we have to be Nick Hornsby?
Because that's like Work in Progress, the one I just mentioned that got picked up. That was one that was made by this gay comic out of Chicago who's been working on it for years. It's like, it's not someone who's like, yes, I'm fresh out of film school. Like, she's been honing her one woman play for a long time, which mm-hmm. this is based on. And so we get a lot of sort of independently made pilots, and episodics is an area that I find really exciting. It's why I'm so psyched to do it at Sundance. So many people who are making films actually kind of want to be making TV, but mm-hmm. you've never really thought of it that way. And I know for us at Sundance, the hope is like that it could be the same sort of marketplace for new creatives in the same way that film is. So the people who are thinking that more in episodic structure, people mm-hmm. who are, oh, I built this whole world and I have a whole Bible with the whole first four seasons arced out, you know, those are the things we're looking for as well. So we definitely have ones that we played that you don't know who they are and you don't mm-hmm. know the actors in them.
Right, it's not Wu-Tang Clan. Or...
No. Those were the ones that I remembered because they're the ones that I was saying is like all of our pitching points during.
Sure.
But the ones that really excite me, it's the same thing. It's the discovery of it.
Right, right.
When you're looking at new pilots, what's the thing that like makes you excited about them, that makes you want to program a pilot?
So the thing that gets me, it's twofold. I keep saying it's twofold, but I guess I'm a bilateral thinker. Who knew? Now what an educational experience for me. One of them is the idea of directorial voice or authorial voice. So much with indie film is this way as well, but I find that almost to its detriment. Like, we'll get a lot of first-time filmmakers who've made this story that's about something really significant to them, and therefore they sometimes are not as tight with it as they should be. They're not as looking at the storytelling. They're looking more mm-hmm. at like, no, but that's how it really was.
Oh, that's how it really happened.
Yeah.
There's nothing worse than being in a screenwriting workshop and being like, well, this is bad, and then being like, well, this is how it really went down.
Yeah.
And you're like, well, okay,
great.
Now.
Well, now we're writing it, so let's do it better.
Or sometimes I'll be like, I don't really believe this. And they're like, no, that really happened. I'm like, well, then write it in a way that makes me believe it. If it really happened.
And so in film, that definitely happens all the time, and you've saved up and you have this one big story. But I think that can fall flat. Whereas with episodic, if it's either webisodes, if you're looking at people making 4 or 5 minute or 10 minute pieces, or more traditional kind of 22 minute length, I think there's a requirement because of the structure to do that editing, to tighten in a way that with a film, it can kind of stay loosey-goosey. You're like, I've got 90 minutes. I'll have this 10-minute scene with my dad that really happened.
Sure.
Like,
that would be a whole episode of your web series.
Right? Yeah. And you're like, oh, we can't do a whole episode with him just talking to his dad. So you have to fine-tune it. So I think it takes episodics, and I'm saying that sort of interchangeably, both for what people think of as web series. I don't really like the term web series only sure. because it has such a like early 2000s.
Yeah, sure. It's on digital.
Right.
Digital
yeah.
series.
Digital series. Yeah. yeah.
You but, say web series and you think, you know.
Like just terrible toaster effects yeah, and yeah. just a really rudimentary filmmaking. And I think there's people out there doing really sophisticated and playful work mm-hmm. that's
independently.
Just happens right. to be episodic structure.
Right.
So, like I said, the fold one of my twofold is having that distinctive voice because, you know, for years, what we've gotten from television has been something that's been so heavily edited through broadcasters, through their weird structure of, oh, I got something picked up for pilot. And now 50,000 people are going to give me right, notes on it.
Standards and practices.
Right. And by the time we see a lot of TV shows, they've been almost euthanized. Like this, mm-hmm. the whole soul has been sucked out of them. And
yeah, you just sand all the edges off.
Yeah. yeah. And so having the ability to just put that forth yourself, if it's online, if it's through festivals, it's the same thing as with indie film, but a lot more people, I think, are taking that on. And I encourage it. I think it's a smart move for showing the kind of storytelling you're able to do, especially if you want to maybe end up in TV. Maybe that kind of structure works better for you. So that was the one fold, is the kind of what I'm looking for right, is the voice. Uniqueness and the voice, but also what is the story telling me that I'm not already seeing? That's mm-hmm. always what we're asking, right? Like I've seen, oh, is this a workplace story of, are there two, is there a receptionist that has a crush on the guy that works sure, at the sure. You know, like there's shows that I've seen iterations for years, but then this is something of, oh, it's brand new, like that I've never seen. For example, I'll use the work in progress again.
Wait, is this part of the first fold? Still?
This is still the first fold.
Okay.
Man, they really, my two folds really sort of blur together, but I'm sure I'll come back to the second fold at some point. But the, but again, in terms of that, yeah, the authorial voice, that work in progress, which I'll just use as my example for this, Abby, and it's killing me, I don't remember her last name, but the creator of it, and she stars in it. And like I said, she's older gay comic who lives in Chicago. And so that's a unique worldview. I don't see a lot of TV shows. And her show is structured about her dating and finding her way around. She starts dating a trans guy, which she's never done before. And so that is a whole, and it's really funny. And also, oh, she's really depressed. I'm like, it's so funny, you guys. She's sure. super depressed.
It sounds like a cable show, honestly, though.
It does.
Right?
Yeah. But she's this, but all of those things are, that's not going to come through your traditional, mm-hmm. like, ooh, I'm going into a network and I'm going to pitch. So I've got this older suicidal lesbian yeah. and she meets a
Tell
trans
me
waiter, yeah. right? Like, yeah. so those are the, but when you see it, she has such a voice and it's so funny and it's so unique and the insights you get from it and the talking points. And the twofold of why I think episodic is the structure of it. I'm looking for something that doesn't just feel like a short film that you've called an episodic. I want it to have the idea of, oh, there are so many interesting narrative threads here that you have built an interesting worldview. I get where I am. Even in 4 minutes, you can see that with things. I get where I am. I haven't seen it before. Oh, I want to know where they're going to go. Where's she going to go? What's he going to do? Mm-hmm. You know, like something that's setting up, that's what you want. And that has this tone, but it also has this possibility to it. Or else it's just a short film.
Yeah.
Short films are great, but that's, it's not the same thing.
Different deal. You know what I love about this, just kind of on a, maybe a more broad level, is that I feel like independent cinema is, economically, business-wise, is like kind of in a weird place right now, where it's hard to make money in independent movies, right? Like you kind of just have to be a rich person or no one in order to get them bankrolled currently, right? It's never been easier to make a movie, but it's never been, but it's still pretty darn hard to find the finances yeah. and make money on it, right? And so I think a lot of the filmmakers who have an eye towards smaller, more intimate, more offbeat stories. You know, if you don't want to do an Avengers movie or a Mission Impossible movie, indie movies used to be the thing that you could do. Now that that's going away, TV is kind of bubbling up, right? But mm-hmm. but there's so many gatekeepers, as you were saying before. And so what I love about Sundance doing these episodic programming slates is like it gives you a chance to do the independent thing that makes money, and maybe you actually will be able to find a marketplace for it.
Well, the hope too, it's in the same way, like with Slam Dance, with the examples I gave you of of directors whose first work we programmed, you probably never saw the first feature that we programmed,
sure.
but then you've seen subsequent work of theirs. And it's the same thing with episodics. It may be, it's interesting. You may not ever see, it's going to be my go-to, but like you may never see the pilot of work in progress that we showed at the festival, but luckily now you will get to see. And there's, it's also the voice of it. Like the Broad City women created their whole characterization, sure. the whole flow of the show. High Maintenance was another show that developed online.
I love comparing those two though, because Broad City, I remember when that show was picked up for like past pilot was greenlit for series. There were like, I swear to God, there were episodes of their web series that had 300 views.
Yeah.
Like no one was watching that show before it became a TV show. Whereas yeah. High Maintenance had a following.
True.
And like, right, right. you know, people were excited about it. But High Maintenance was the show that like people would be like, oh, have you seen this cool web series?
Right. People were paying on Vimeo to watch it.
Yeah. Yeah, I think I did, actually.
Seems like something
you do. Support an artist.
Yeah, yeah.
Well, the thing that's nice about them as well, and that stands out maybe is something that's more of a threat.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.